The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Another week of broadcasting lined up here on KPCG.fm. This is the week, of course, we kick things off for the Philadelphia Youth Camp in Edstone. Had a few emails with my wife early this morning, who is still back in Edmond. She'll be coming back with our kids and some others from the Edmond camp. They had a big bash last night with the awards ceremony and singing and all kinds of other things, I would imagine, as the campers were able to say goodbye to one another and come home, probably all sunburned and worn out and exhausted. So it'll be exciting to see a few from that camp coming over to the camp here in the UK. It's quite a bit cooler on this side of the world. And there's also quite a few coming to this camp as their only camp experience for this summer. It'll be considerably smaller, 33 or 4 campers, I believe, and then quite a few workers added to that. So that is off and running this Wednesday night. I thought I'd start this segment with some feedback that came in from one of our regular listeners down in New Zealand, who commented on the couple of programs that we had last week about the rising tensions in Jerusalem between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And she says here that she's been listening intently and that it's really opened her eyes to better see what is actually happening. She says the information on the news here in New Zealand was rather scant and hardly anything about what you talked about on the Trumpet Daily radio show. And she said she's very appreciative for the show and also the Trumpet website and for some few sources that we often cite on this program, like Melanie Phillips, who tell the truth about what's actually happening in Jerusalem. And when you learn the truth, I mean, it is alarming. When you know what's prophesied, when you know where this is headed, she says here, I have listened to your program with Mr. Brent Noctegal a few times to be able to digest this riveting news. As you spelled out with the prophecies in Zechariah, there is a God in heaven who reigns supreme, and through your programs, you're helping us to see the God behind the prophecies, that as they come to pass, we might believe. She says here, words are inadequate to express my gratitude for this precious truth that you bring us daily. She's very thankful for knowing the truth, for understanding the truth, in particular about Jerusalem. I know over the course of my job in God's work, I think I've been to Jerusalem or to Israel maybe 25 times over the past 20 years or so. I spent some time living there in 2007, and then again in 2012, most of the year in Jerusalem in 2012, much of the summer of 2013. And if you go back earlier than that, in the 1990s, I traveled over there frequently with Andrew Locher, who you've heard on this program once before, and my father, as we went on those television taping tours, taping Key of David programs all over the state of Israel. And in the many times that I've been there, particularly when I lived there in 2007 and 2012, I went on a lot of press tours and sat in on a lot of press briefings. And one of the things that, if you're into the news and if you get into some of those media tours that Israel does a pretty good job of carting reporters around the country to let them see what's going on. We took one tour up on the border with Lebanon once, and they took us right up next to the fence. And our tour guide got us out of the bus and showed us where several years ago these Hezbollah terrorists broke a hole through the fence, came over, ambushed an Israeli military vehicle, and then took two of the Israelis hostage back to the other side. And so he was just there basically pointing out, this is what happened right here. This is where they came through. That's where they shot this vehicle. And then, of course, it led to this big back and forth between Israel and Hezbollah. And the same thing has happened before with Hamas as well. In any event, they're always very informative. And you're on the bus or you're in the press briefing room with lots of journalists. And over the time that I've been involved in these, when I've been over there, you're going along trying to record all the facts, and then every once in a while you'll hear what one representative or journalist for the New York Times or Reuters or AFP or the Associated Press, what they raise their hand to ask or what they stand up to say, and you can hardly believe what comes out of their mouths. The bias, the distortion of information. Someone once told me that there's more international journalists in Jerusalem than in any other city in the world. And I've not verified that with a study of my own, but I suspect it's probably true. I mean, it's a prestigious city to have a bureau if you're a big news agency or organization. And as soon as something flares up in Israel, you can oftentimes get some live or on-hand reports. But here they have all of these journalists. Here they have all of these reporters. And yet the news that comes out of Israel is astounding in just how distorted it often is, and how biased or anti-Israel the bias is. And I think, as this listener down in New Zealand brings out, I was just thinking on it a little bit more this morning, because, back in the 90s and even 10 years ago or so, when we lived there in 2007, you can remember even relatively small incidents that got a lot of coverage. I mean, it was as if the magnifier was put on a small clash in Jerusalem. And yet, as this listener down in New Zealand brings out, there really hasn't been that much coverage last week, considering this is a major incident. I mean, for the first time, weapons, guns coming out of the Temple Mount and being used against these Israeli policemen, these Druze policemen. And I think what it shows, I'm sure there's still quite a few journalists that reside in Jerusalem, but I think that what it shows too, just with the widespread diffusion of knowledge, the internet, and then too, just the ever-lowering standard of morality for so many in our nations. And what you get when you turn on the news, there may be a little snippet coming from Jerusalem, but what you get when you turn on the news in your local area, just like this listener brings out, is just so much trivia. That's what we're saturated with, popular culture. And so really, it's like we're going against not only the spread of that, just trying to get the truth out amid all the noise that's out there. But then even when you have reporting from Jerusalem or from Israel, then you have to also expose the lies and the bias. It does make you appreciate those, as she said, those few sources that are there trumpeting the truth. She says, "I love your radio show because of the truth, the biblical aspect, the relevant and awe-inspiring scriptures that you give us. I must add, your interview with Mr. Noctegal was spot on. I actually felt in that program as if we were in the thick of something big, like we were there. It's another aspect of Bible prophecy, soon to explode at any moment. Well, there are many explosions going on at the moment in and around Jerusalem over the weekend. There was another gruesome terrorist attack, this one in the West Bank town of Halamish. On Friday night, this large Jewish family of about, I think, 10 people, they had just settled in for their Shabbat dinner. Large family, grandparents, children, grandchildren. And late Friday night, this 19-year-old Palestinian climbed the fence surrounding the Israeli kibbutz, broke a window in the Solomon home, and then stormed into the house with a long knife that he used to murder the grandfather and then his two grown children, badly wounding the grandmother. And that terrorist was then shot by a next-door neighbor who heard the screaming. And one of the wives of the victims was upstairs with many of the grandchildren, calling 911, trying to get the police out there. Well, this teenaged killer, he was 19, and he was shot, as I say, by one of the neighbors through the window, but he survived the shooting, and they took him to the hospital, and after being questioned by the police, he said that he bought the knife 2 days earlier and that he wanted to kill Israelis because, this is according to the Times of Israel, because of events surrounding the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And so because of all these events, and by that he means the so-called Israeli attack on the Temple Mount, he purchased a long knife and went in to murder these three Israelis. The Times of Israel has this to say. Hebrew media, citing Palestinian sources, reported that 2 hours before the attack in Halamish on Friday, the terrorist published a post on Facebook calling for the need to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The need to defend Al-Aqsa, which sits on the Temple Mount alongside the Dome of the Rock. The IDF released a photo of the post in which he wrote, according to a translation, this is what the terrorist wrote on Friday afternoon. He said, "I have many dreams and aspirations. I know that with Allah, my dreams will come true. I loved life." He thought he was going to die in this attack. He didn't. "I loved life," he said, "making people smile. But what kind of life is this? To kill our women and our youth, defile our Aqsa while we sleep." This he used as justification to kill women and youth. He said in this Facebook post, "Take your weapons and resist. I only have a knife, and it will answer the call of Al-Aqsa. You start a war amongst us, and Allah will judge you for it," he wrote. He wrote that 2 hours then before he jumped the fence and smashed a window and started stabbing that family. Now this attack, Friday night's attack, as Melanie Phillips brought out over the weekend, it's a direct result of the incitement of the Palestinian incitement, Palestinian leaders, including Mahmoud Abbas, who are out there calling for violence, calling for Palestinians to protest, calling for a day of rage. They're out there promoting these kinds of attacks because Aqsa is under attack the way that these teenagers see it. That's the message that comes through loud and clear. And it's not based in truth. It's not grounded in truth. The fact is, I mean, this was a troubled young man, as other reports bring out, who was just using this latest fake news, if we can call it that, as a pretext for his attack. The actual truth, as I covered with you last week, is that weapons are now coming out from the Temple Mount, and that's a game changer. The Temple Mount is being used as a staging ground to war against Israel. Melanie Phillips brought this out on her her website in this little clip. This is clip one.
Means that the Temple Mount, which we are told is, you know, the holiest place or one of the holiest places in the Muslim world, is being used as a weapon store and as a center of terrorism. Now, we've seen it being used as a center for terrorism in the last few months with the attacks called the Al-Aqsa Intifada attacks perpetrated on the false idea that Al-Aqsa was under attack by Israel, and attacks taking place from Temple Mount with rocks being hurled down and so on. But this is, to my knowledge, the first time that we have seen a weaponized attack from Temple Mount itself. And it does suggest, and I know the Israelis have said this, there have been unofficial reports, I believe, saying this, that Temple Mount has been used as a weapons store. And clearly, if you have terrorists running, as we saw on the video, from Temple Mount, armed, and killing the two police officers as they ran from Temple Mount and then running back onto Temple Mount, then it does inescapably suggest that Temple Mount is being used as a theater of war.
That's Melanie Phillips from her website. And as we covered last week, the reason this is so important to watch is because this is these 37 acres. This is the most hotly contested territory on earth. That Temple Mount compound. I mean, both sides are digging in their heels. Of course, it's a nationalist symbol for the Arabs and the Israelis, but I mean, that's a religious center really for three faiths, including Christianity. And so what happens when you have this sharp of a division between Jews and Arabs, between religions, these great world religions as well? What happens when this compound, this supposed holy site, becomes a staging ground for war, becomes a weapon store, or a center for terrorism? Well, Israel, as we covered last week, they put up the metal detectors. And that, as we've now seen, is used as a pretext to murder more Israelis. That is seen as an attack on Al-Aqsa, Arut Sheva. This is a right-wing publication in Israel. This was a blog posting. This author here says, the outrage caused by these metal detectors frightens Israel's leaders. They don't know if they should keep the detectors in place or take them down to appease Palestinian leaders. And the pressure, of course, is coming from the international news media as well. It's coming from those journalists, the hundreds and hundreds of journalists in Jerusalem. And most of them, by the way, live in Jewish neighborhoods, in the Jewish quarters, that as an aside, decrying these metal detectors, the fact that they would be put up at an entrance where mostly Arabs go through. This posting says, the Fatah organization headed by Mahmoud Abbas called for Palestinians to march on security checkpoints in Judea Samaria, essentially calling for mass disturbances against security forces. And that's what went on Friday. And one young man was so enraged that he purchased a knife a couple days before and broke into a home inside of an Israeli kibbutz and went on his rampage. He says this metal detector story proves just how far away peace really is. In Israel, he goes on and describes how many metal detectors are in Israel. He says they're almost ubiquitous, and I can attest to this having lived there. You can't go to oftentimes the grocery store or a restaurant without going through a metal detector or without at least opening up your bag. You go out to Malka Mall on the outskirts of Jerusalem, you go through metal detectors. You go to the central bus station, you go through metal detectors. You come into the country, you're going to go through metal detectors. You go out of the country, they're everywhere. And like I said last week, they are there at the entrance to the Wailing Wall as well. And at other entrances to the Temple Mount through which the Jews go in and out. But that one entrance where the Muslims go in and out, you can't have them there because, well, it would humiliate them. That's what the Western media is reporting. That's what the Palestinians are up in arms over. He says, I've never seen anyone, Jew or Arab, put up a stink while going through our metal detectors. They're all over Israel, he says. And especially so in Jerusalem. He says later on, it's not like Israel is the only place Muslims see a metal detector. Arab governments use them too. For example, in 2011, the Saudi government announced that it would install metal detectors at Mecca's holy mosque. Listen to this. Metal detectors at Mecca's holy mosque. There were no Arab protests or violence over this announcement. You heard nothing. In 2011... He says, so if Muslims accept the metal detectors at Mecca without complaint, how do Muslims in the Palestinian Authority react to Israel installing its own metal detectors at the entrance to the Temple Mount after a terror attack? They claim it humiliates them. Metal detectors at the Temple Mount are a horrific, unacceptable Zionist humiliation. For the PA, the Palestinian Authority, there's only one cure for such humiliation: violence, rage, and rioting. Violence, rage, and rioting. That's the response. It's interesting, the Associated Press, I think this was from yesterday, it kind of summarized the coverage, or rather the events of the last week and a half. And for most of the article, it was back and forth. You know, the Palestinians did this, they killed those two policemen, then the Israelis did this, and then this happened, and then this happened. I'll give you an example here. It says, the father of the 20-year-old Palestinian assailant said he believes his son was upset over the loss of Palestinian lives and wanted to protect the honor of the Jerusalem holy site, the Al-Aqsa, in other words. It says, a senior Israeli government official blamed the latest round of violence on what he said was Palestinian incitement against Israel and called on Palestinian leaders to help restore calm. Muslims alleged Israel was trying to expand its control at the Muslim-administered site under the guise of security, a claim Israel denies. Okay, so it sounds relatively fair and balanced, right? Back and forth. Then this, it says, Ibrahim al-Abed, an uncle of the assailant, said his nephew had been arrested 3 months ago by security forces of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Now listen to this, because this is fundamentally, this is what all of the bias stems from. I mean, there's an anti-Israeli or an anti-Jewish hatred that's there as well. I guess that's maybe a fundamental foundation of the bias as well. But with respect to the Palestinians, this uncle of the killer, Friday night's killer, says that just a couple of months ago, he had been picked up by security forces of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who presides over autonomous enclaves in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. So it's Israel's territory, but they've given a lot of control in those Palestinian areas to Mahmoud Abbas's security forces. It says the uncle said his nephew had spent 2 weeks in detention and was violently interrogated about alleged plans to attack Israelis before he was released. And so what he's saying there is, look, Abbas's forces, they've worked to support Israel. They're working to prop up Israel. And it says here later, this is the Associated Press, Israel has repeatedly accused Abbas and his Palestinian Authority of permitting anti-Israeli incitement in the public Palestinian discourse. Abbas has rejected Israeli incitement allegations, saying that Israel's 50-year-old occupation of lands sought for a Palestinian state is the root of widespread Palestinian anger and helps drive violence. So one side believes this, and the other side believes this, and then what does the Associated Press say? It says, Abbas is a staunch opponent of violence and in 12 years in power has stuck to security coordination between his forces and Israeli troops. Abbas, they emphatically state, is a staunch opponent of violence. That's something right there that you would never hear them say about the government of Israel. A staunch opponent of violence. And it says, and in 12 years of power, he stuck to security coordination with Israel. In fact, it's Israel's security forces that's kept him in power, because Israel withdraws from the West Bank. The first thing that happens there, as we've pointed out before, is that Abbas's Fatah forces are overrun by Hamas. And so he does have to walk a fine line and sort of present himself as a more moderate representative of the Palestinian people. But make no mistake, since that attack and then the closure of the compound and then the installation of those metal detectors, Abbas and other Palestinian leaders, the Palestinian media, certainly Hamas too, they have been inciting violence. They're responsible for what they say. They're responsible for what they broadcast on Palestinian TV. They're responsible for what they put in their newspapers. And organizations in Israel that take the time to read them, to get the translation, to see what they're saying, they know it's obvious. And it should be just as obvious for every single reporter and journalist working in Jerusalem. Every international journalist working in Jerusalem should be able to see it, just with a little bit of digging, so that they could then report the truth. So that they could then tell the truth about metal detectors in Israel, in Saudi Arabia, in every major airport in the world. Zechariah 14, 1 and 2, remember. Half the city, Jerusalem's going to be cut in half. That prophecy, as we went through it last week, I mean, it gives us the big overview, and it all revolves around Jerusalem. God says he's going to gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. And that, of course, is talking about the nations, plural, that gather to fight against the return of Jesus Christ. Just before he sets foot on the Mount of Olives, that runs right alongside the old city of Jerusalem. That runs right alongside the Temple Mount area. But before those nations assemble, it says Jerusalem's going to be taken. The houses rifled, the women ravished. You know the verses. We read them last week. And that's talking about the king of the north, the European beast power that comes into Jerusalem after it smashes the king of the south. You can read about that in Daniel 11, verse 40. And what did Jesus say in the Gospels? What did he say in his Olivet prophecy? His disciples, remember, came to him and said, hey, tell us. Tell us when the end of this age will be. And tell us what will be the sign of your coming. And Christ went on to talk about a lot of prophesied events to unfold in our day. And he said in Luke's version, Luke 21:20, and when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is near. You better know when you see those European armies surrounding Jerusalem, coming in as the great peacemaker. Well, we've got to, because it's so violent. It's so divided. And it's so important, and it's so central to three world religions and to two peoples. Christ said, when you see that happen, when you see those armies surrounding Jerusalem, well, I'll let him say what we're to do. Verse 21, then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out. And let not them that are in the countries enter therein too. God's people are told to get out of Judah, to flee to the mountains. And in verse 24, this is also in Luke 21, it says, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. See, that's the time we're entering into, the times of the Gentiles. That's why you see so much working against the little nation of Judah, Israel, and the same with Britain, and the same with the United States. These nations that used to have the upper hand. These nations where God used to intervene to spare us, to protect us. I was able to see the Dunkirk movie yesterday. And of course, I didn't go in expecting them to really stress the miraculous hand of God who intervened so that the weather worked in favor of that rescue operation for the Allies. While at the same time, it worked against the Luftwaffe. It worked against the German Air Force. And then the fact that Hitler, for some inexplicable reason, you got to believe God's hand was involved. He stopped his troops just short of where all those hundreds of thousands of Allied troops were trapped. And he just let the Air Force take care of it over several days. And of course, several days in, that's when he awakened to the fact that there was this massive rescue operation that saved 338,000 lives. French soldiers, British soldiers, they lived to fight another day, and they did fight another day. And then there were other miracles later on in the story. Like with Normandy, the invasion of Europe, when those troops came back and liberated Europe. And it was just routine back then in the Times and the Telegraph. And they'd cite all of these principal players involved. Of course God's hand delivered us. Of course God saved us. I mean, people were fasting and praying in this nation so that the people of Britain would be spared, would be delivered. But now it's so very different, isn't it? Because we're coming into the times of the Gentiles. And those that were once leading the world are now near toward the bottom. And you have other ascendant powers filling that power vacuum. And what does it all lead to? You can keep reading in Luke 21, there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations. It says men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Yes, indeed, we're very near to that unprecedented time of suffering, great tribulation. But verse 27 says, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and glory. It all leads to the return of Jesus Christ. And Christ said in that Olivet prophecy, when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near. When they begin to come to pass, I mean, even before Christ gets back, when you see this sequence of events, as hard as it is to recount some of these atrocities, lift up your heads. Lift up your eyes, Isaiah said. And know that your redemption draws near. And know that there is a solution. And know that there is something to be positive about. We can't get discouraged. We have to have the courage to trumpet God's warning message. And then also we have to have this ever hopeful attitude and mindset. We're so close. Jesus Christ is about to return. Don't lose that hopeful, positive outlook. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, like our regular listener down in New Zealand, you can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Another story from here in the UK over the weekend involving this drugstore called Boots. I never understood when I moved here why it was called Boots. I still don't know why. In any event, for you American listeners, it's very similar to Walgreens, CVS, those kinds of stores. And there was this campaign leading up to last week, this British Pregnancy Advisory Service. That's a leading provider of abortion care, if you can call it even care. But it's basically an abortion provider. And this campaign was intended to reduce the cost of a fairly popular abortion pill, the morning after pill, it's sometimes called. So there was this campaign for all of these drugstores and supermarkets and such that sell this particular drug to get the cost down from 28, 29 pounds per to 5 or 10 pounds to make it easier, basically, for gals that have had sex and then think that they might have gotten pregnant to then go and take the abortion pill the next day or whenever to take care of what they see as a problem. In any event, Boots was just one store. All the rest of them said, okay, yeah, sure, we'll look for ways to reduce the cost. Boots came out with an announcement on Thursday night. This was last week. On Thursday night, they came out and said, we're not going to reduce the cost because we don't want to be seen as incentivizing inappropriate use. In other words, we don't want to give these gals incentive to behave recklessly. And then, well, it's a fix that only costs 5 or 6 pounds. So that was Thursday night. Friday, the uproar. Friday, the female MPs in the British government, all up in arms, submitting all of these statements, coming together, putting pressure on Boots, saying that you better bring those prices down. Don't you start preaching to us. Don't you start lecturing us. It says here in The Guardian, Boots, this is from a statement of these female MPs, many of them prominent MPs. The Guardian's quoting from their statement, Boots' justification infantilizes women and places a moral judgment on them. It says here again from the statement, women do not need to be disincentivized by Boots to make personal choices about their bodies. We women go to Boots for our products, not moral guidance. Public opinion is not on their side. So if they're worried about complaints, they are listening to the wrong voices. And customers should vote with their feet. And in response to that, what do you suppose happened? Boots immediately apologizes. Immediately, Boots comes out with a statement. You're right. We got it wrong. We're sorry. I can't believe the way we behaved. I mean, within 24 hours, their apology, it reads, announcing the retailer's change. Well, this is quoting from The Guardian. Here's the spokesman for Boots Friday night. He said, pharmacy and care for customers are at the heart of everything we do. And as such, we are truly sorry that our poor choice of words in describing our position on emergency hormonal contraception has caused offense and misunderstanding. And we sincerely apologize. And so you have to go along. You have to go along. You see, the majority, as the female MP said, the majority are on our side. Look, everybody's going along with this. Who are you to stand against it? Who are you to sermonize? Who are you to say anything about how a woman should behave or should not behave? I keep coming back to that statement in Melanie Phillips's column from last week about all the theories and policies and everything in our culture not that long ago. Those things that were once thought to be beyond bizarre, now they're not only tolerated, now they've not only been adopted as mainstream, they're compulsory. You have to go along. And more and more, people go along. Or if not all of them are going along like that the elites think, well, the media, the major media, they just say, well, everybody's going along. Everybody's on our side. We're in the majority. It's what everybody thinks. I mean, everybody knows that Mahmoud Abbas is a staunch opponent of violence. That's just common knowledge. That's conventional wisdom. And everybody knows that a girl ought to be able to have an abortion. And she ought to be able to do it cheaply. It's a lot of pressure Satan applies to forcefully impose his will Read about that in Colossians 2. The will, it's a lot to stand against. Look at that example in Genesis 19. I mean, these two angels came into Lot's house and said, look, this is, I mean, you're living in a wretched environment. Evil, every evil and perversion imaginable and unimaginable. You're going to have to get out. And God had to practically drag that family out of there. It says in one verse that they were lingering. I mean, these were pretty good people. Evidently, the two men that were going to marry Lot's daughters were, they were going to marry virgins, and they hadn't taken advantage of his daughters. They were preparing for marriage. Lot was married. He and his wife lived in their abode, the two daughters, the two sons-in-law. It says in Genesis 19, in verse 14, Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-laws. I mean, they were pretty good men by today's standards. But a lot of that society had rubbed off on them. A lot, they recognized that there's a lot of evil. There is a lot of evil in the world today. But there's also a lot of good. I mean, there's so and so down the street. He's a good man. He's an upstanding individual. And Satan, meanwhile, he just keeps taking it down, down, down. How strong must the pull of the world have been in the days of Lot for these two young men to practically mock God's servant and then to linger? I mean, they had to be constantly prodded to a point where these two angels actually seized Lot and his wife and the two daughters, seized them by the hands to drag them out. And the two sons-in-law just mocked Lot. And then, of course, you know what happened to Lot's wife. They got a good ways out of Sodom. And God rained fire from heaven. And she turned around. Lot's wife turned around longingly to gaze upon her hometown. It was so hard for her to leave. It was so hard for her to let it go. See, what we want is God's perspective. We want God's view of this world as it is today and the new world that's coming. We want to see that new world for sure, not just dwell on the negative. We've got to lift up our eyes, as I said in the last segment. But the point I'm making here is just how strong the pull of this world really and truly is. Mr. Armstrong said in Mystery of the Ages, he said, I think one of the greatest tests that everyone whom God calls, one of the greatest tests that everyone whom God has called faces is giving up this world and being part of it. See, we want to be part of it. We want to find a little nook or a crevice and say, well, that's a good part. And I can hang out over here and it won't be too bad. As long as I don't get involved in what, you know, those others are doing over there. It's our greatest test, giving up this world. And look at the course that this world is on. There was another piece in the Times just, I think, today or yesterday, about how British authorities are doing everything they can to make it easier for people to get a sex change. We've got to make it easier for abortions. We've got to make it easier, you see, for people to change genders. We've just got to do everything that we can to move this along, and everybody better be on board with it.
Everybody better comply. We've got a majority on our side, they say. And it's no different over in the States. I read this. I didn't read it. I think I referred to it last week. It's about the laws of, or the rules of the U.S. military. They're rewriting the rules to accommodate the transgenders. It says here, this required, I'm picking it up in the middle of a thought here, this required some cunning feats of Orwellian doublethink, as commanders simultaneously had to deal with the disproportionately high rates of female lower body injury. This is talking about the changes in the U.S. military from a number of years ago, when they started putting women into the front lines of combat or in training for those front lines, with the excuse that, well, we're both the same, right? There's total equality. And so then there were disproportionately high rates of female lower body injury, because as the Bible says, they're weaker vessels. But you can't accept common sense. You can't accept Bible truth. They had to deal with the loss of women from ship crews to pregnancy, and of course the constant thrum of sexual harassment reports. I mean, you've got to force women in the name of equality, in the name of fairness, and then what does it do? It introduces all of these problems. It says here, this period of madness, doublethink, and mad policy is covered in my book. He plugs his book there. Now the madness that the U.S. military has accepted, the orders it's attempting to carry out full throttle, is the idea that someone who decides he or she is the opposite sex and lives that way for a proscribed period is to be considered the opposite sex. So if it happens in the military, well, that's the way the society's going. So the military has to comply too. Says James Hassan, a former Army captain, did the world a great service by publishing pages from Tier 3 Transgender Training, a new set of procedures for commanding officers in a recent article for The Federalist. The training manual contains a number of vignettes addressing stuff like how showering should be handled and how to conduct a urine test, whether the transgender soldier is the tester or the testee. The training manual contains such gems as women soldiers may be asked to share a shower room with a soldier who, because she did not undergo a surgical change, still has male genitalia. So just because he says it, I mean, he may be allowed to just go right in there with the women. These are the new standards. This is the transgender training manual. And on the craziness goes. It takes a lot, doesn't it? Really, it takes a miracle. It takes the power of God to, as Paul said in Ephesians 6, to stand against the devil, to stand against his influence, to resist against it so that he'll flee from you. Ephesians 6, verse 10. Let me just read these few verses here in conclusion. Paul says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. That's where we have to go. If we want truth, if we want strength, if we want courage, if we want God's perspective, we receive that from the Lord. Be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. I mean, there's power there. There's real strength in God and his spirit. Paul says in verse 11, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. You're going to have to put all of the armor on if you wish to stand. And we've got to stand against the wiles of the devil. We've got to stand against the devil's influences. We can't go it alone. If we're out there on our own, we will cave in. We will cave in within 24 hours. We will come out with statements of apology after having a relatively strong stand, and by that, really, it's pretty weak. I mean, they're selling the abortion pill anyway. So that's not exactly a strong moral stance to just keep it at 28 pounds instead of 12. But you can't even as a company keep it at 28. Because, well, that discriminates against women. Because, well, who made you? Who made you, God? Who made you the standard? Why are you preaching to us? Paul says here in verse 12, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." That's what we're going up against. And it's going to take the power of God to resist against it. One final verse, verse 13. Paul says, "Wherefore take you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand." Have you done all to stand? That's what God is asking. That's what God wants to know. Have we done everything that we can to stand firm against this world and its ways? If so, God will give us the power that we need to make that stand even stronger. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us, tdkpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.